The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
This program contains explicit content and subject matter which may be unsuitable for some listeners. Discretion is advised.
Smart. Sexy. Kinky. Fun.
Welcome to Sex Out Loud with your host, sex educator, author, and filmmaker, Tristan Taramino. It's sex-positive radio like you've never heard before. Tristan talks about sexuality from every angle with leading authors, experts, artists, and icons. From sex education and sexual politics to BDSM and non-monogamy, nothing is off limits. So get ready to open your mind and expand your horizons. This is Sex Out Loud. And now here's your host, Tristan Taramino.
Welcome to Sex Out Loud. Hey, I want to remind you that the Lambda Literary Awards are on June 1st in New York City, and I am presenting an award. It is such a star-studded event with everyone you'd ever want to know from the world of LGBT, queer, publishing, editing, writing, and it's going to be so much fun, and you can get your tickets at lambdaliterary.org. Also, August 4th, I'm going to teach Anal Pleasure 101 at the Pleasure Chest on the Upper East Side in New York City to kick off Anal August. That's a free event, but you have to get there early, pleasurechest.com. And I really hope you're going to join me in Burbank, California, along with some of the top names in the field of sexuality this September 11th to the 13th at Catalyst Con West, which is a three-day conference that was created to inspire exceptional conversations about sexuality, with more than 70 speakers presenting over 40 sessions on everything from sex education and erotic writing to sex-positive parenting and slut-shaming. Catalyst Con West will be held at the Los Angeles Marriott Burbank Airport Hotel. And for more information, go to catalystcon.com. You can use the code Tristan for $10 off your registration. And while you're there, check out my sex educator boot camps, which are happening prior to the conference on Thursday and Friday. It's amazing professional training for sex educators, and I hope to see some of you there. Today's show is the final in a series I recorded at International Ms. Leather, and my guest was Susie Q. Let me tell you about her. Susie Q is the creator and host of the acclaimed podcast, The Whorecast, which showcases the stories, art, and voices of American sex workers. As an active sex worker herself, Susie Q is committed to fighting for sex worker rights and ending exploitation within the industry. Her column, The Whore Next Door, runs every week in the San Francisco Weekly, and she also writes for Eros Media and Radar.com. When not feverishly writing or rushing to her next interview for CNN, Wired Magazine, or USA Today, Susie Q teaches classes on non-monogamy with her co-host and fiancé, Jesse James. She hosts a Game of Thrones podcast called Winter is Coming on Your Face, and stars in feminist, fetish, and mainstream porn, which garnered her a 2015 AVN nomination for Best All-Girl Group Sex Scene. Fighting for truth, justice, and the American whore is what Susie was born to do. And here's my conversation with her. I am here at International Ms. Leather 2015 in San Jose, and I'm talking to actually one of my fellow judges this year, who I've gotten to spend a lot of time with, because the judges, if you don't know, in this contest are sequestered, first of all. So we spend a ton of time with only each other, and we are worked very, very, very hard.
I mean, there are 14-hour days here, people, and math even.
So, Susie Q, welcome to Sex Out Loud.
Hi, I'm so happy to be here. Thank you so much for asking me. I'm so flattered. I was so excited to hear that you were on the judging panel, first of all, and then you emailed me and asked me to be on the show, and it's just the best ever, so thanks for having me.
So, I want to start with I want a little backstory. I want a little origin story from Susie.
Great.
How did she get to be sitting here today?
Oh my gosh. Like,
with her pig earrings.
With my pig earrings. Oh, well, these just came from a co-op in Portland. But, I was raised in a theater, first and foremost. Like, that's my life has been next to or on a stage since almost before I could walk. So I think with that, I mean, historically, you know, I like to say actresses and whores have always kept pretty close company and have generally held a lot of the same status in society until kind of recently. So as I aged and became, you know, started really delving into the, you know, the world of theater, and I went to and got my bachelor's degree in it, and I stumbled across a book called, Real Live Nude Girl by Dr. Carol Queen. And that inspired her performance piece. And this is a super heady response, but I mean, like, yeah, I read that book and it was about the Lusty Lady Theater. And when I eventually, like, graduated and moved to the big city and didn't like my retail job and was done, you know, teaching theater for not very much money, I said, you know what, it's time. I'm going to go investigate this place and, you know, dive into this world, which is so close to my own world. I mean, like, I grew up idolizing women like Mae West and Gypsy Rose Lee, who, like, held that space in between the mainstream and, you know, the body. And that space was very interesting to me at the time. It was right around, like, when people started to, the neo-burlesque movement was really picking up speed. So I was interested in all that stuff, and I dove right in, and it just kind of kept going from there. And then eventually I decided to make a podcast about it, and people started listening.
So what was your experience like at the Lusty Lady? Because, you know, the Lusty Lady, for people who don't know, is kind of a unique place.
Very.
It is not your... It is not neo-burlesque, but it is not run-of-the-mill peep show strip club.
Right. It's actually, there's not really anything like it on Earth at all. And at all anymore, because it did close in September of 2 years ago, I believe. So I remember going back to my college town at one point, and like very early on, as I just started dancing, maybe 6 months or so, and I told one of my like... not even very close college friend, someone who I'd been on improv team with. And I told her where I worked and what I did. And she said, oh, is that like burlesque? And I was like, no, it's not. But yes, there's clothes, but you don't take any clothes off is the thing. This is the thing. The peep show. Have you seen the Madonna video from the 80s where I don't even remember which song it is, but there is like, you know, you see the window and the door starts
to go up.
You put money. It's got this like carnival.
It might be Open Your Heart.
It might be Open Your Heart. Open your heart to me. Yes, I think that's it.
But okay,
you know.
Well, someone maybe will call and tell us what it was.
Exactly.
Okay.
But yeah, so you went into this little booth, you put money in. A peep show is from before the days that people could just plug into the web and masturbate in their homes. In order to watch porn and masturbate, you had to go to a place where you could access the porn and masturbate. So it's these little closets. And so... right off the bat, instead of just like working in a regular strip club, which is like lap dances and actually in some ways more like burlesque, I was dealing with people's direct, like full on sex fantasies. I was dancing naked for people, and we weren't doing like sex shows on stage when you were dancing with the other dancers, but in the private pleasures booth, which is what I had read so much about in Carol's book. I was negotiating little mini sessions with people around like, okay, well, if I fuck myself with this dildo and you, you know, call me dirty names from the other side of the glass and get yourself off, like that's going to be $60 and da 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 da. Okay, great. And go, like, you know, and I think I really got some important chops there. Moreover, I was surrounded by this group of women who had unionized long before I got there.
Which is extraordinary.
Extraordinary.
In the world of the sex industry, of peep shows, of strip clubs. I mean, it's just not done.
Totally. And also owned the place. They had bought it from the owners that they had unionized, you know, under. And, you know, it was a co-op. So it was the world's only worker-owned, unionized peep show in the world. Like, how could I not work there, you know? So, and it, which attracted a certain like social justice-y punk riot girl crowd, including just like all types of folks and women who, you know, wanted a steady paycheck in the sex industry, because that was one incredible thing. It was all money above board. You got a W-2 and a paycheck, and it was very, even if you didn't hustle enough tips because somebody came in and was a fucking asshole that night, you still got your hourly wage, which is another thing that's very different from a regular strip club, which folks are always independent contractors. Sometimes you even have to pay to work.
And you have to hustle.
Yes, and you have to hustle. And me, you had to hustle at the Lusty too, but not in the same way at all. So it was a very special place. And yeah,
I miss what did it. You learn about yourself? I mean, I think that there are these narratives of sex workers, unfortunately, still that are pretty, you know, they've been traumatized and taken advantage right. of, and they finally sort of escaped sex work. I'm guessing you had a different experience, but I'm not going to make any assumptions.
Right.
What was working there like?
It was monumentally incredible. Like when you hear alumni, especially now that it's gone, when you hear alumna of the Lusty Lady speak, it sounds like they're speaking of a summer camp or a sorority, or it was this profound community of sisterhood, where I quite literally, you know, there in certain sororities you have like a big sister, little sister, so you get assigned somebody when you first come in to teach you the ropes, because there's no handbook for sex work. You know, there's all these horrible narratives out there for us to digest and chew on and, you know, internalize, but there's very little, you know, mentorship out there, opportunities for it, and so that was just built into the structure of the Lusty. So it felt like summer camp. Like, we had this shared journal that we kept in private pleasures called the Booth Book. And we would just write each other notes. It would be like, you know, dear Lusty, like, this is what's going on for me right now. And people would get very vulnerable. Like, I got to know those women. It was like epic note passing in class. I remember in high school. And you, like, know the way someone writes. And that, like, you know something about them because of that. That's how I knew my coworkers. Like, the bond of sisterhood was incredible. And like the mentorship around like, okay, like if you have a shitty client who is like trying to haggle you down, like this is what you do. This is how you get out of that situation. This is how you stay safe. This is how you advocate for yourself. So it was very profound.
So you had this ultimately positive experience.
Totally.
But were there bad days at work?
Always. There's always a bad day at work. And no matter what job you have, I remember this thing has been burned into my memory, because when you walked into the dressing room of the Lusty Lady backstage, there was this little cartoon that I believe Annie Sprinkle did, who was another one of my inspirations and mentors. And it's this little, like almost like New Yorker cartoon called like, "What Does Sex Worker Burnout Look Like?" And it was like all these little, you know, things that, yeah, happen. You know, you suddenly start not wanting to go to work, or like, oh my God, if I have to ooh and ah and be a sex kitten one more moment, I'm going to scream, or like, get me out of this box that all of these men are gazing in at me. Like, I'm going to get my period tomorrow and I hate everything and I don't want to be naked, you know? That happens, Lord knows. And so, but when too many of those days happen in a row, like if you don't do, like anytime I think you're using your mind and your body resources, like for your profession, you really have to prioritize self-care. And that's a really important lesson that we all kind of learn as we come into adulthood, I think. And that was something I definitely learned at the Lusty, around like what that concept of like sex worker burnout even might be and how to combat it. Like, you know, but yeah, there's always going to be a bad day at work. But I think it's really unfortunate when people pathologize that. And like, it's very easy to do that internally to yourself too, of like, oh God, I am so cranky. Well, it's probably because I'm a hooker. You know, no, it could be because like maybe your blood sugar's low and like it's been too many days without a day off. So that was huge.
Okay, so speaking of hookers,
yes.
At some point in your life, you began, I believe, to identify as a whore.
Yes.
Because your Twitter is The Whore Next Door.
That's also the name of my column in the San Francisco
right.
Weekly.
That's
yes.
also the name of your column. And so, and then you have the Whorecast.
Yes.
So whore is a big word that I imagine holds a great deal of power for you.
Totally.
And I want to hear about that.
That word really speaks to me in, I almost want to say, a very holistic way. You know, when I think of the word I think even before I was reading Annie Sprinkle and Dr. Queen and stuff, I remember in high school, like junior year AP English or something, we read The Chalice and the Blade, which is all about, you know, this anthropological idea of the sacred feminine. And like the Da Vinci Code was the thing for the time. So the idea of like, you know, Mary Magdalene, like the whore archetype, has always really rang true for me, because Lord knows that's what women who go on stage and like to be loud and wear red lipstick, that's what they are, right? You know, regardless of whether they have sex for money. So even before I was a pro, that word didn't hold as much like negative connotation to me. And, you know, I'm going to come out about something, but having been like a college feminist and like done the vagina monologues and gotten the cunt monologue, I was very familiar with this idea of embracing a word that was once derogatory. So yeah, I think like the whorecast, when we decided to start the podcast, and it was definitely inspired by like activist moments around, Prop 35 and anti-trafficking legislation. But mostly I'd had the urge ever since working at the Lusty Lady to put these voices of these people that I was encountering in my community and getting to learn from, elevating those voices into the world. Like, there's so much wisdom here, and people think that these people are worthless. Like, that has to change. And so the whorecast came from that, and I wanted to put sex work, all sex work, you know, not playing the hierarchy. Oh, I'm a stripper now, or I can tell this person I do phone sex, but I can't tell them I actually do sessions, or I'll do porn, but I won't talk about street work or whatever. I wanted to like get away from all of that. And, you know, cause we're all in this fight together. And so by using that word that people have used on us in a terrible way in the past, using that in a positive way to unite us is what I wanted to do by using it.
Okay.
On that note, we're going to take a break.
Yay.
But when we come back, more with the whore next door, Susie Q. So stay with us.
The Internet's number one talk station. Number one talk station. VoiceAmerica.com.
Ready to take your sex life to the next level? Let Tristan Taramino's award-winning expert guide sex education series help. Each DVD is packed with honest information, explicit techniques, scorching sex scenes, authentic chemistry, and real female orgasms. Go to puckerup.com and use coupon code SEXOUTLOUD for 25% off your order.
Follow us on Twitter at VoiceAmericaTRN. Get the lowdown on guests, new shows, and your favorites. That's VoiceAmericaTRN.
You're tuned in to Sex Out Loud with your host, Tristan Taramino. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, please send an email to Tristan@puckerup.com. That's Tristan@puckerup.com. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sex Out Loud. Today I'm talking with Susie Q, who is a sex worker, an activist, and host of the podcast, The Whorecast, thewhorecast.com. And so before the break, we were talking about the word whore and reclaiming that. So tell me, let's back up and tell me more about how the whorecast came about.
Totally. Okay, so in November of, I believe it was 2012, there was a proposition that was on the ballot in California called Prop 35. It was a piece of anti-trafficking legislation, which, you know, human trafficking, force, fraud, or coercion of someone's labor, whether that be in the sex industry, the garment industry, you know, the agricultural industry. It's an atrocity. It's not something that us labor rights-minded folk are about at all. However, the anti-sex trafficking movement has really gained a lot of momentum and has kind of chosen the entire sex industry as their scapegoat around all of this. That in order to solve all of the human trafficking, labor rights atrocities in this world, we need to get rid of the sex industry? All of it? That will solve it? Someone decided that at some point. And so this piece of legislation was a perfect example of that. It really lumped all of sex work into the definition of human trafficking. And it did end up passing. But before it did, I knew I had to do something more than just, you know, cast my ballot and Facebook about it or whatever. And my partner, Jesse, and myself, we're big Kevin Smith fans. And so we were on a road trip listening to Tough Shit, his book. And like one of the chapters, he gets really, really evangelical about podcasting. And I love podcasts. I always have, like, some, you know, not always. Of course, they haven't always been around, but I'm a big Ira Glass fan. Dan Savage, I love your show. And Jesse was just like, why not? Like, why don't you start a podcast? We have all these incredible people. You always, like, talk about all the wisdom that's out there. Like, why don't we do it? So we did. And it's gone very well. It's been a little over 2 years ago, and it's just been an incredible journey.
Well, it feels like you've tackled a lot of different issues on a podcast with a lot of different kinds of guests.
Yeah.
One thing that's noticeable up front is men.
Yeah.
Cisgendered male sex workers who, God knows, really don't have a voice. Mm-hmm. Even in sex worker spaces sometimes. We say sex worker, people think of women.
Absolutely.
They do.
And by and large, like, absolutely, there's a lot of women who do sex work. And one of the reasons I think I chose the sex industry is it's one of the very few industries where women actually make more than men. Mm-hmm. So I think that people tend to forget about cisgendered men in the world of the sex industry. And, you know, those folks are part of my community as well and have incredible stories to tell. Like Jack Hammer is a cancer survivor, Gulf War veteran, BDSM porn star, magic man. Like, what? He's just, you know, Baltimore Orioles fan. Like, how can I not? Like, he's one of the most interesting, like, incredible people I've ever met. Like, you know, it's just these stories are amazing, you know. And that's not even, like, who fucking cares if they're amazing? The point is that they're not given a fair shake. These voices are silenced, you know, unless they're fetishized. And I wanted to make a space where, you know, what I told Jack when he came on the show, you know, he had been fired from his vanilla job because he had been outed as a sex worker. And I said, I don't know, whenever your case is ready, whenever, like, it's not going to affect litigation, and whenever I can help you, whenever, like, my platform can be a platform to further the story that you need to tell in this world, like, that's what I'm here to do, you know? Lord knows, almost every time I feel like I get contacted by mainstream media around sex work stories, so often it's this weird overlay they want to put on it, and they want... the sex workers they're contacting to play a certain role and play the whore and, like, you know, use a cropped image of just your high heels or cut your head off or, like, whatever. So I just think it's so important that we have these platforms to be able to tell the stories in the way we want to tell them.
And, you know, I think you're very embedded in this community in San Francisco, which some might call unique, some might call a bubble, mm-hmm. some might call radically progressive in terms of just being the center of the sex positive movement,
totally.
Right? Are you conscious of that when you're putting together the show, of how to reach beyond a particular, because even, like, there are these particular crappy narratives. Mm-hmm. I think there's also a particular San Francisco
happy hooker narrative.
Happy hooker. Okay, so let's call it the San Francisco happy hooker narrative.
Totally. Yes. And, you know, within, like, the first month or two that we did the podcast, we used to do these, I think they were, like, trivia. I'm such a trivia buff. So we would do, like, Whorecast trivia, and people could play along at home, and then I would send them, like, some crash pad porn or something. And within the first month, I was sending porn to New Zealand, Alaska, New York, Kansas. And so while, yes, like, I'm very cognizant of, like, okay, like, not everybody thinks about things in the same way we think about things here in San Francisco. Totally. Like, cultural bubble. Absolutely. And, you know, it is the founding of the sex worker rights movement happened in San Francisco. We've got I don't want to say a leg up, but, you know, a certain ethos. But I know that we have listeners because they write to me from all over the world. And it's very easy to find community in San Francisco. You know, you go to a swap meeting or, you know, it's...
Tell us what swap is.
Oh, sorry. The Sex Worker Outreach Project, which is an advocacy group. And there's many chapters all over the country. But, you know, accessing community is so crucial to not feeling isolated and alone. And it's very easy to feel isolated and alone in this industry. And so people write to me from all over the world saying that, you know, the Whorecast gives them that, you know, even if nobody knows that they're a sex worker, getting to listen in each week and hear other perspectives from other people in the industry. And I always try, like, I really keep the show almost candy sweet at the beginning and end. Even if we talk about hard issues and I get really mad or get really snarky or go on a rant at the end, what I want people to know is like, hey, you're okay. You're doing a great job. I love you so much. I'm going to see you next week. Okay. Like, because I really do. Like, this movement is growing. Like, there are sex workers all over this world. People think that it's this marginalized thing, but we're mothers, we're daughters, we're brothers, we're sons. Like, we're everywhere, and it's so hard for people to come out because the risks are so big. So, I don't know, I got kind of off on a rant there, but yes, I do think about the bubble, and I'm always trying to be in service to my listeners and to the community, like, first and foremost. I don't want to be like, hey, it's great, don't worry about it. Like, I want to, like, it's tax time. I want to put out content about, like, how to pay your fucking taxes, how to survive in this world, you know? That's the bottom line for me.
And so, speaking of taxes, you talked about being a labor activist, and I think people are still wrestling with this notion of sex work as work, mm-hmm. and as a job, right. and as labor. So I was hoping you could sort of tease some of those ideas out for me.
Sure. Yeah, I think that there is a notion about people don't see sex work as the job, you know, separate from the sex worker. And I think that, not that those things necessarily need to be separate, but I think people see it as like a lifestyle or a mistake or this like weird narrative or like speaking about the type of person that you are, a character trait. Like, no, it's a job. It's a job. And the reality is, especially coming off of the recession that our generation just saw, the 2008 recession.
Is it over?
It's not
really.
Now everyone's just rich here and it's just the worst for all the people who aren't. But, you know, like in my time as an adult, I have seen the economy in this country take a huge nosedive. I have seen college educated people who were promised these, you know, yeah, you go to master's degree and then you can like get a really great high paying job. False atrocities. not real any longer. And people have had to get creative about how to survive and how to, you know, feed themselves and pay their student loans. And for many people in this country and around this world, that has looked like sex work, you know? And my mother always taught me, you know, my mom was around during the second wave feminist movement. And one of those values that I was raised with was like, you get to do what you fucking want with your fucking body. And nobody, especially not a man or a societal structure, can tell you otherwise. And like second wave feminists and third and fourth and beyond wave feminists sometimes disagree. But I think like that's a common thing that we share, and that's why the leap for me of, you know, how to do sex work as a feminist was very, very clear, and why I think it's, you know, my dad's also a labor rights guy, heavy union guy, so like the idea that you can do what you want with your body can be a tool to help you survive economically. When you get paid for something, that's labor. Labor rights are important. Like, what's missing about that equation for most people? You know, like, you do this work to survive. You should be paid fairly for it. That work is just as good as any other way a person tries to survive in this world. So, like, why shouldn't you be treated with all the same rights as any other laborer?
Gosh, that raises so many questions.
Sure.
I want to go in three different directions.
Great.
I'm going to try to gather my thoughts. So stay with us, more with Susie Q when we return.
Streaming live, the leader in internet talk radio, VoiceAmerica.com.
Ready to take your sex life to the next level? Let Tristan Taramino's award-winning expert guide sex education series help. Each DVD is packed with honest information, explicit techniques, scorching sex scenes, authentic chemistry, and real female orgasms. Go to puckerup.com and use coupon code SEXOUTLOUD for 25% off your order.
We're making it easier to listen to the Voice America Talk Radio Network live wherever you go on iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android. Download it from the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
You're tuned in to Sex Out Loud with your host, Tristan Taramino. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, please send an email to Tristan@puckerup.com. That's Tristan@puckerup.com. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sex Out Loud. We are talking with Susie Q, the creator and host of The Whorecast and a sex worker rights and labor activist. So lots of things popped into my head as you were talking in the last segment. I'm going to try to organize my thoughts. Well, the first thing I thought was this notion that sex work falls into an entirely separate, different category and we can't apply the same rules because it's sex.
Right.
So the thing is that I've had a lot of jobs in my life. I have worked straightforward retail at a chain restaurant. I've babysat. I have worked in corporate America where I had to wear a suit every day and pantyhose for a major media conglomeration. I've worked for myself. I've done various kinds of sex work, and that may be news to people who maybe have just found me through this podcast, but I'm going to come out as a sex worker because I am. And then you can quiz me about it, I guess. And the truth is you have bad days at work and you have bad experiences at work and you have power struggles at work and shitty bosses and shitty coworkers and, you know, and I can tell you of all the jobs I've ever had, working in mainstream Hollywood has felt the most soul-sucking, detrimental, just draining on every level and exploitative, actually. And I also have worked these like random jobs where I just didn't really like my boss or I felt like there were dynamics that I wasn't happy about. But when we apply this to sex work, because we're using the body and sexuality as a vehicle, I feel like a bad day at work becomes trauma. It becomes violence. And sometimes it is violence. And there is very real violence against sex workers in this country. More so than violence against people who work at a copy shop, for example.
Totally.
That is a fact. But I feel like we put it over in this other category and say, if you had a bad day at work, you have been demeaned. If you had a bad day at work, you are in a dark, dark, deep, horrible place. If you have a bad day at work, you've been triggered and traumatized and maybe trampled upon. Physically or emotionally or psychically. Why do we put it in such a special category?
I mean, the simple answer is misogyny generally, but like, you know, I do this, that's the simple answer of just like, oh, well, that's like a woman doing sex. Like that's suddenly pathologized and wrong for all of these reasons around like femininity being bad and evil and ugly and, you know, the source of all evil. That's the simple answer. But I think that, you know, I think that's at the root of it, that people have, there's this long, long historical history of women owning their sexuality being brutalized at the, you know, at the core of it.
Or at the very least being punished.
At the very least being punished, you know. And so I think that's where it stems from, of like it can't just, because I mean, you think about other jobs that work with the body that can be traumatic. Like a bad day at work for a doctor could involve like a child dying, you know. Like my partner, Jesse, he was an EMT for a while. And I was also, so it was like, you know, the EMT and the whore. And like for the longest time, he had like worked in education, which is another, you know, draining activity in and of itself. But he was always really, you know, he is always really great and there as an ally for me. But when he was doing EMT work, I had to step up as a partner and be there for him in similar in ways that I had not before at other jobs, because he was dealing with death and trauma and really way more intense shit than I was dealing with. Like I was dealing with people's orgasms generally. Like it's really, most days are fucking fine, you know, like in comparison to dealing with like poop and blood and death and vomit. Like That shit is also really traumatic. But do we pathologize EMTs and say that, hey, you're less of a, you should really get out. Do you need help? Do you blink twice if you're being coerced by the ambulance company? Like, you can tell, you know, we don't do that because primarily men do those jobs, you know, I think, for a variety of other reasons too. So I think it's very interesting that, like, yes, at the core of sex work, it is like, it is a body labor job. But all of these other activities that are body labor jobs can be so much riskier than, you know, coal mining, Jesus Christ, underwater welding is so dangerous. Do we tell those people that they need to be saved? No. But, you know, the simple answer is misogyny, because it is historically, you know, this women's space, and the whore archetype is a woman. We're punished accordingly, you know?
So you also talked about your mom and dad. Mm-hmm. What do mom and dad think?
Well, there is a podcast that I did that's a conversation with my mom that I did just like over the holidays. It's fairly recent.
such a perfect time.
Right, exactly.
Everyone's going to go home and have awkward conversations at the dinner table. Let's do a podcast like that.
Might as well. No, my parents are incredible. I mean, who do you think introduced me to the work of Gypsy Rose Lee and Mae West? My mother. You know, she's... God, I love her so much. She was a, you know, Red Power activist in the 70s. She's very involved in tribal politics. She is such a badass, the original, like, badass archetype woman in my life who would, like, come. She was, like, directing One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest when I was, like, in third grade. And I was like, I want to be just like you. So she's incredible. And when she first found out that I had, like, done some porn in college, she flipped the fuck out and could not handle it. But I think it was mostly just because she didn't like my girlfriend at the time that I had done it with. She was like, fuck no, forever. Porn is forever, which I understand now. Mm-hmm. I'm a little sad, too, that there's all this porn of me and my horrible girlfriend. Oops, sorry. But, you know, college. And my dad, he was taking me to, you know, union protests and dead shows when I was 8 and 9 years old. And so when I told him, finally, that I was doing sex work, I told him about The Lusty Lady. And before he said anything about, like, stripping or sex work or anything like that, he was... Actually, I think the first thing he said was, like, oh, my God, I'm so proud of you, because of the labor rights organizing. Like, he understood that, like, sex workers organizing and unionizing was fucking huge.
Monumental.
Like, and he was just, like... You know, he identifies as, like, a feminist labor rights dude, so deadhead. So he was... The first thing he said was how proud he was of me, and he reads my column every week unless I tell him not to.
Oh, so there have been... I didn't get that. We didn't get to have that, like, sort of consent story with my mom. My father passed away before I began what you will all know as sort of the public Tristan Taramino.
Right.
But I'll never forget that my mom would read my Village Voice column religiously and give a few... thoughts, pointers, and critiques. She was also an editor and former English professor, but I'll never forget the time when she read this column I wrote about how I love enemas as a fetish, as a BDSM activity, as a power exchange, and then a story about, you know, an epic sort of enema scene, and she called and said, okay, so this week's column, enemas. And I thought, no, wait, no.
I want to go back.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's hard. Okay, so there are times when you set a little boundary.
Yeah.
And you say, not this week.
Totally. And, like, they totally get that, you know? Like, my mom, I think, sets her own boundaries and, like, accesses what she's comfortable accessing. Sometimes I'll be like, hey, did you read this? And she's like, no. I'm like, okay, that's fine. It's totally fine. But she came on the fucking podcast. Like, gee, they're very, very supportive.
Yeah. I also did a podcast with my mom. Isn't that funny?
Yes. It's, I mean, like, it's such, I think, I mean, I'm also,
and
like,
she embarrassed me.
Of course.
Embarrassed me.
Always.
I am not an embarrassed, I cannot be embarrassed. No one can make me blush. Howard Stern, bring it on. My mom told the story about me masturbating, and I was like, I need to leave. Oh, wait, but it's live, so I have to stay here.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God.
They're
still
the worst.
And I'm still teased about that. Yes.
No, supportive parents is such a, like... blessing and a curse. You know, my parents have always been very, like, involved. They were, you know, I did a lot of theater, so they were always, like, volunteering to stage manage and volunteering to do lights and all that stuff. So, like, now that I'm in this industry, they understand that there are, like, boundaries. But, like, any opportunity that like, it is appropriate for them to, like, be in, they're always, is this a show we can come to? Oh, no? All right, that's fine. Well, you let us know, and we'll be in the front row, sweetheart. We love you so much. Like, it's like,
you are the whore next door.
I'm a little.
And you have the parents of the whore next door who just seem, who need their own show, I think.
Oh, God, they do.
I want to meet them now.
You will.
We're going to take a break, and coming up, I want to pick Susie's brain about feminist porn as, you know, a piece of the sex worker puzzle. So stay tuned. More with Susie Q when we come back.
Stimulating talk
gets those synapses in the brain firing really fast.
All the time. The number one internet talk station where your opinion counts. VoiceAmerica.com.
Ready to take your sex life to the next level? Let Tristan Taramino's award-winning expert guide sex education series help. Each DVD is packed with honest information, explicit techniques, scorching sex scenes, authentic chemistry, and real female orgasms. Go to puckerup.com and use coupon code SEXOUTLOUD for 25% off your order.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/Voice America.
You're tuned in to Sex Out Loud with your host, Tristan Taramino. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, please send an email to tristan@puckerup.com. That's tristan@puckerup.com. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sex Out Loud. I'm talking today with Susie Q, who is a sex worker rights activist, a columnist, and runs her own podcast, which you absolutely have to listen to, which is called The Whorecast. And Susie, I want to talk a little bit about feminist porn.
Totally.
And one of the things that I think came out of the Feminist Porn Conference last year, which I found to be kind of a next step in all the shit that we're talking about, right, was that for many, many, many years, one of the tenets of feminist porn has been that feminist porn depicts authentic pleasure,
right?
Authentic experiences, authentic orgasms, authentic connections between people, sometimes real life couples or lovers. And that authenticity, the idea that the person had a really good time, that has become a central tenet. But there's been this counter narrative, which from sex workers themselves who say, you know, this is problematic because I don't want my enjoyment. First of all, how are you going to measure my enjoyment?
Right.
And I don't want my enjoyment to somehow affect if I'm recast, if I'm paid, if I'm paid on time. Like, so where do you fall in this argument?
Totally. Okay, so feminist porn, I love. It's like the bulk of my porn career. It's how, you know, I like started. And so I think for initially, that was definitely like how I thought about it too. It's like, especially entering for the first time, like, okay, I think I'm going to shoot my first porn scene. But I don't know, I would really like to do it with like the person I'm dating right now. And like, could we just, can we just do it this way? And like, can I just like make sure I come? I think it's a great place to start, especially for like an entry level position, you know, as I felt like I was doing my first like couple, you know, feminist porn scenes. But yeah, and this came up for me at the conference as well, and I wrote about it, like that idea, I guess, it gets a little dicey, I think, in terms when you think about, especially as we try to move forward into the brave new world, and we hope that like more and more porn is feminist porn. And I think that when we think about feminist porn, what I like to think about is, you know, feminism as this social justice movement that is like include social justice elements such as like really fair, awesome labor practices. And in my experience, feminist porn has included that for the most part.
Across the board?
I wouldn't say across the board, because I think, and that's not necessarily a feminist porn issue. That's true of like indie porn in general. When the budget is low, sometimes little things don't, you know, you don't get the best snack, you know, or like you end up being your own costume designer slash helping PA, you know, that's not a feminist porn issue necessarily, but like, you know, I've encountered that in the worst. You said Hollywood, I'd say for me, indie films, like I've been paid like the least and respected the least. Like, oh, but no, you're going to be a real actress now, you know? Right. And I think anytime you leverage some kind of, you know, like, oh, well, you're also going to get this, so I can pay you less or treat you a little bit less well, that you're in a dicey situation. And like, I think that maybe some people had that experience making something that was called feminist porn, and can be called feminist porn if you want it to in many ways. I think that when we play the identity politics and say like, this is not, again, we get a little dicey as well. So like, I think that, you know, the feminist movement needs to always be evolving and like changing and growing in different ways. And I think this is one of them. And I think that conversation that happened at the Feminist Porn Conference most recently around like, well, what about like the labor part of authenticity? And I think the way I frame it is, you know, my background is in the theater and is in acting. And you try to be so fucking authentic when you're in a movie or you're on stage, you know, when you're crying, those tears are real. You're really going through that, you know? So getting to that place and being able to perform that or access that, you know, like I can make myself come really, really fast and have a screaming, very awesome, very, you know, believable because it is real orgasm. I can also fake a really good one that looks almost exactly the same, you know, and that's a skill that like I should be compensated the same for as long as the user experience is the same. And I think that acknowledging that the feminist porn audience wants something that reads authentic, real couples, you know, female pleasure centric, something that has all those, you know, I think that the labor rights aspect and then the marketing strategy, which we all have to be like honest about as well, are a little bit separate, and that's okay. That's totally okay. Like, yes, there's a whole, you know, consumer base of people who like feminist porn and like these things of, you know, placing, you know, maybe not having a money shot or placing the female orgasm as the center stage. That's fine, but it's, there's like artistic choices as opposed to, and then we can also add the layer of like, and on a feminist porn set, you're paid on time, nobody's racist, like all of these other things as well. I think they go hand in hand.
But should it be kind of a mandate that you have a good time?
No, I don't think it should. Because I think it should be a mandate that you're treated well and you're given every opportunity to have a good time, you know, but everyone's responsible for their own good time at the end of the day, you know, and I think it's fine if even a feminist porn director says, oh, like maybe I don't want to have that model back. It didn't seem like she had a very good time. Well, when you're on a feminist porn set and you're looking for, okay, like in the scene, we really want you to believe that you guys are a real couple and like this is going to be all about your orgasm. So I'm going to come in close on your face when you come, and that actor gives a dead like, or I'm having a horrible time face, then like the job has not been adequately, that's not what the director's looking for. And that's also okay, you know, but I think the main thing is that having a good time is not leveraged as a way to like be paid less or treated unfairly. You know what I mean? I think I've been in situations where it's like, yeah, but you like that stuff, so it's okay that you know, only made $300 or whatever. And that's mm-hmm. something that like shitty clients do, not like feminist leaders of the world, you know?
Well,
like,
that's a slippery place.
Yeah.
That's another slippery place we get into, which is liking versus not liking, doing it and liking it, doing it and not liking it, not liking it, not doing it. I've lost track, but let's talk about that.
Yeah, totally. And I think it's different as like, you know, as a freelancer, I will choose projects. I may play that game with myself of like, wow, okay, well, I don't like... it's a little bit under my market rate or what I might ask for a project, but like, I really believe in it and I want to get this thing off the ground and like, we're shooting this pilot and what the hell? Like, I really love these people and I love working with them, anyway. Whereas someone from the top, holds the power, holds the money, saying like, well, we're friends. So how about we just, we want to fuck anyway. So like, why don't we just film it and it'll be like really fun. It can, it'll be fine. It'll be great. Holding someone's pleasure as a way to leverage, like I said, like not compensating them appropriately, I think is where like I draw the line. As a freelancer, yeah, you're in situations and as like an independent artist where you're bartering different skills, like here and there, especially like getting these projects specifically in film out there. But I think it's about who has the power in that negotiation. You can negotiate like that with yourself and like check in with yourself. But when it turns into like a boss employee or a contractor, independent contractor, things get a little dicey.
So we're here at International Ms. Leather, and as judges, there's great flexibility in the interview process. But what has kind of evolved is that each judge has a series of questions that they begin to ask over and over and over again.
Right.
And you are unabashedly, shamelessly the sex work activist, and you will ask the sex work question every single time.
Pretty much.
And actually, I want to say that one thing that surprised me, if I'm being honest, is just how many of the contestants have done some kind of sex work at some point or are still doing it if you would have asked me before, give me the numbers, percentage of contestants who've done some sex work, I would have said, I know this is your issue, Susie Q, but I think it's going to be a reach for some people.
Yeah.
And then hearing their stories, it's not at all a reach. Mm-hmm. I mean, that surprised me. And I think I went in having one assumption and I was proven wrong. But where do these intersections lie, and what do kinky people still have to work on around including and embracing sex workers among us?
I have been so moved at IMSL this weekend because I felt like it was such an honor, and I felt like I was chosen potentially based on some of this activism stuff that I've been doing. So I felt like I had to ask those questions, especially because historically the leather community has had some ambivalence. And even today I had a conversation with someone about like, yeah, I know I'm fine and good with sex work and everything, but if a pro-dom came into a dungeon and had a client that was paying her, that would be wrong. I'm like, okay, like,
this didn't happen in the room when I was there.
I don't know if it did. It was like side. It was not the contestant.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so I didn't hear that, but certainly the sentiment. I've heard the sentiment expressed. Okay.
Absolutely, and like, it's funny because it was with a fellow judge. You've heard me ask that question basically of the contestants, for the past day and a half. So I like this person and I have far more in common than we have not in common. This little sticking point, and I was just like, yeah, but. I feel like some of that stuff is kind of rooted in the stigma of like, well, why? Like, what? And he's like, well, what it would be akin to if I came into a pro-dom house and expected to play for free, that I walked into, the gates or somewhere and was like, okay, well, I want to do what I do, but I'm not going to pay anybody. And I'm like, well, okay, but what if you and I had negotiated that you were going to like clean my house on Sunday and I would give you an hour session or whatever, or I would take you on a date to the Citadel and do this needle scene with you or whatever. Would that be wrong? Like, if we had negotiated something, like, isn't one of the tenets of what we're trying to do here that two consenting adults can do whatever they want with each other? Like, isn't that the sexual freedom part of our agenda? And he was just like, oh yeah, kinda, fuck. I think sometimes we don't even realize the bias that we have because we've been raised with it. Lord knows, I'm sure like that was a sentiment that was passed down for like several maybe generations of leather folks,
Of keeping these two worlds very separate.
Exactly.
And of saying this is community space and that's the other ironic part about it. This is community space where we're all doing what we quote wanna do. I think as an organizer of an event, the interesting thing is that there are some legal implications of having people doing sex work on site under the rubric of your event.
But my experience is that sex workers don't really announce that they're doing sex work or their clients. So I actually, if you asked me to look at five scenes and walk through in a row, and you said to me, which of these scenes is there money being exchanged, I actually couldn't tell. I mean, there's no way for me to know.
Exactly. And I think that, yes, like while keeping in mind that it is the risks of having the work be criminalized is important, the fact that the work is criminalized is an injustice that I believe is current and part of the fight. I mean, when you criminalize the work, you criminalize the worker. And these people, like I said, are people who are trying to survive. These people are part of our leather community, as we've seen this weekend. You know, it's not the scary pro-doms that lurk in the corner and try to come to our parties and do sessions. Ugh. No, these people are part of our community. They have just been scared to come out. Like in the feminist porn movement, the leather community is also having similar evolutions. I think the time is really ripe for people to listen and to learn and to build new bridges that will only make these movements stronger as we forge ahead into the brave new world. Not the brave new world, that's scary, but the amazing new world.
And on that note, thank you so much for talking to me, Susie.
Of course.
It was such a pleasure.
Thank you. You're amazing. Thank you so much for having me on the show. Such an honor. And I can't wait for more magical leather stuff tonight.
Yes.
It's going to be so good.
Find out more about Susie Q at thesusieqexperience.com and listen to her podcast at thewhorecast.com. Follow her on Instagram and Twitter at Susie Q James and also on Twitter at whorecast. Tune in next Friday, 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern for another edition of the show. Until then, you can see us on Facebook. You can go to our Twitter feed at Sex Out Loud Radio. And remember, talk about sex out loud.
That's a wrap on today's show. Go to voiceamerica.com to listen to this and other episodes on demand or as podcasts. And make sure you come back next Friday night at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 Pacific, for Sex Out Loud with Tristan Taramino on Voice America Variety.